for you, buddy. No, just a second.
Oh, there's some lane.
There she is. All right, Charlie. Okay. Good afternoon. It is literally afternoon. And I want to welcome you all here and thank you for coming. I'm Leroy Barker. I'm chair of the State Bar Historians Committee and who sponsors the Bar Association. Our committee sponsors this program every year. We've spent two special guests, Justice Fade and Justice Winfrey, with us today.
Good.
We also have some students from the West High We the People team and the Anchorage Youth Court. You want to stand up just briefly? I know you're eating.
Wow, that's half the room.
You're looking at your future judges and lawyers. I want to thank the people that put this program together. They did the real work: Sheila Gallagher, Barbara Hood, Marilyn May, and Bill Oberle. Margaret Newman with the court system, and Deborah Reagan, the executive director of the bar, Mary Patrick, the CLE director, Amanda Kramer, and Sharon Leon. And I want to thank all of them and give them a hand. They did a big job. And the Great Harvest Bread Company, thanks to Barbara Hood, provided the bread, which we will, at the end of the program, figure out a system to present that to one person at each table. This should be an interesting and informative program. I think it will bring back a lot of memories for those of you who lived through these times. Reflections of the early years of Anchorage Women Lawyers Association, but can she type? And I'm going to set the tone by telling a personal experience that I had. I started law school in 1958 at Bold Hall, and the dean was William Prosser. And put it simply, he hated women. And so at orientation, it was look to your right, look to your left. One of you won't be here next year. There was a class of 340, and they had 12 women. We had 12 women. The largest number of women they'd ever had at Bold. He said then, after reading us, there are 12 women in this class. If I had my way, none of you would be here. But the dean of the graduate school said I had to have some women. So there's some women in this class. And it's incredible to think, but that's what the five of them of the 12 graduated. One went on to be a prominent lawyer in Texas. One worked for a Wall Street law firm. One became a Superior Court judge. And another became president of the local bar association in Northern California. The fifth one was Joanne Garvey, and she is the most interesting. And I confirmed this with her the other day to make sure I got my facts right. She was fifth in our class of 140. She could not get an interview in San Francisco, and they told her quite bluntly she was a woman and they didn't hire women. She eventually went on to a very prominent career. She became a partner in Heller Ehrman, and Later, after Heller Ehrman left, she's with partner with Shepard Mullin, which is a major West Coast firm, and she's in their San Francisco office. She also ran for president of the American Bar Association. And she said to me, but the one thing I liked about Prosser is when you were in his class, in his tort class, he would never call on a woman. We have an outstanding panel today, and I'm going to introduce Jessica Graham. Well, let me say the biographical sketches are in your program, so we're not going to take the time with those. I want to introduce Jessica Graham, who is our moderator for the program. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Leroy. Welcome, everyone. We have a great panel. I am tempted to just dive right in, but we do have a very special guest in our audience that is particularly worthy of recognition in an event like this. And so I would ask us all to recognize Jan Wilson, who is sitting right here at our front table. Jan was admitted to the bar in January of 1951. I am told she was the fourth woman admitted. And I think as Linda pointed out, or maybe it was Judge Hunt, she was a partner with her husband. And so for all practical purposes, she is very likely the first woman partner in Alaska. So welcome. We're very glad that you could be here today. So I'm the moderator. It's my role to get the conversation going. I will say that I am a longstanding and active member of the Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers, and have been for about the last 10 years. I had breakfast this morning with this panel. They are extraordinary women, and they have an extraordinary story to tell about how the organization grew and developed that really left my jaw dropping. I had no idea how this organization came into being and the path that was paved by the women that are sitting here. So it's really going to be extraordinary today to hear them tell that story. One administrative note, you all have pink cards on your tables. If you have questions, as the panelists are discussing today, we'd ask that you write your questions on the pink notes, and a member of the Bar Association will come around and pick those up and bring them up as soon as possible so that we can present those to the panelists and have as much dialogue as possible. And with that, I'd like to turn to Judge Hunt. And I was told the biographies are in your program, so I'm not allowed to go on and on about Judge Hunt. But everyone here knows Judge Hunt. Thank you for agreeing to be here. And she's going to start and talk about the founding of AAWL.
Thank you. I was startled by her comment because I remember a DA introducing a criminal defendant in a sentencing hearing by saying, "And everyone knows this defendant." I thought, oh my God. Okay, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I have to tell you that as I look around the room, I'm so pleased to see Jan. Thank you for coming. But also I realize that I really am talking about history to many of you. And on one hand, I am so pleased that it is history, that this need or these needs no longer are perceived as existing. But I have to tell you that although that thrills me, it also makes me a little nervous because, as I think Linda and Elaine will point out, there are still some concerns that women in the practice of law need to be aware of, not only for themselves, but for each other as well. But I've been asked to tell you about the beginning. I'm going to start with just a bit of personal history. I started law school in 1971, and like a lot of women in that group and in that period, I already had a career. I mean, I had been a teacher, I had a master's degree. They were published while I was in law school, but I was in the process of finishing writing two grammar textbooks. And so when I went to law school, I considered it to be something that was a new career direction. But when I got there, first of all, I found out that history hasn't changed much, Leroy, because there were 11 women in my law school class, the most there had ever been. And yet, it made up less than 5% of the class. And we found ourselves, along with the four women from the year before us, getting together quite often because we just felt like we needed answers to try to figure out, how do you do this? What's going on? Who's doing what? In other words, we got together to be a source of information and support. So then I had that experience when I was in law school. So graduated in 73, you know, did the whole thing, law review, order of the coif, top 10% of the class. And then because my husband had already moved here, I moved to Alaska along with a family of five kids. So I knew when I got here that I wanted to meet other women that were involved in the practice of law. So I went to the Anchorage Bar Association luncheons. And I looked around, and there were like maybe two or three. And I thought, surely there are more women than this in the practice of law. So I went to the Alaska Bar Association, got the list. There were 27 women admitted to practice law living in Anchorage. So I went back and wrote a note to every single one of the 27 women, inviting them to lunch, same time, at the what is now Hilton Hotel. And I sent out these invitations. And I just said, you know, I'm new in town, I'm admitted, and I'm with this firm, and I would like the opportunity to get to know you. I got responses back, and two of them were particularly memorable. One of them was very clear. This woman advised me she did not meet with women, she did not believe that it was professionally advantageous to meet or associate with other women lawyers, and she was sorry that I had that attitude. Another woman responded, telling me that she would probably not be able to attend the lunch, but was very sweet, I thought, and very kind, because she read my note as seeking ways to meet people in Anchorage. And so she gave me a list of ways and places I could go to become socially integrated into the community. Now, I think that note was very kind, but what struck me about both of them was they both were addressing the idea of women getting together, one seeing clearly where I was headed, and the other one thinking not in terms of women being involved because we were in the same profession. So women showed up. Now I have to tell you that this process went on for months. This process of every month I would sit down and handwrite an invitation to every other woman admitted to practice in the city of Anchorage, inviting them to lunch, always at the Hilton Hotel, always in the same room, and frankly, as much as I could, always on the same date. Because I wanted to develop the idea that we would get together. Now, one of the PSs to this is I was very, very careful that no one in the firm ever thought I was using firm time, firm stationery, or firm postage. This is why they were always handwritten, because I wouldn't use the copying machine at the firm. So we began to meet on a regular basis, and our topics were all over the place. But always was the topic of whether or not we should organize as a group, call ourselves something, write bylaws, and become an entity that would be recognized. And there was great controversy and heated discussions about whether or not this should take place. So we continued to do this, it's my recollection, at least about a year, if not longer, okay? Now, I want you to consider what the practice of law in Anchorage was like at that time. Very few private firms had hired any women at all. And other than the possibility of Jan with her husband, there were no women who were managing any law firms. To the best of my recollection, in fact, there were no women partners other than, I think, Jan with her husband. And there were no agencies, federal agencies, that had women that were in charge of the agencies in the AG's office or in public defenders. I remember well that if you went into federal court, you had to wear a dress. And there are some wonderful stories involving a woman lawyer who challenged that. Another time, another conversation. In the Anchorage District and Superior Courts, Judge Moody was the presiding judge, and he had a dress code. And I don't require that it required women to wear dresses, but my recollection is we mostly always did. Okay. One of the problems with trying to organize as a recognizable group of professional women meeting on a regular basis to discuss common issues and common topics of interest was a great concern about what the reaction would be of the male attorneys in the community, because many women that were involved in the practice of the 27 were involved. They were working for and had male employees or male supervisors. And so the big question and the big debate was always, what are the men going to think? What are the men's reaction going to be? How are they going to treat us as professional women if we form a group called the Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers? Now, I see some smiles. I hope those are smiles of recognition. If not, they've got to be smiles of, my Lord, what a silly thing to be concerned about. But it wasn't. Because if you were a woman employed by a man who thought he had gone way out to the edge to hire you to begin with, if you were seen as an organizer, if you were seen as someone who didn't want to conform with the legal profession as it was and as it was practiced, you put your own career and perhaps even a significant part of your family's economic well-being at risk. So these were important discussions. But I want to tell you how they got resolved. There was a woman by the name of Dorothy Holland. You may recognize her if you're a history buff, because she was a signer of the Constitution for the state of Alaska, and she worked in the AG's office. Dorothy was a very small woman. She was only probably about 5'5" at the most. She was very small, and she was very soft-spoken. You rarely, if ever, heard Dorothy raise her voice. But there was this one meeting, and we had had a particularly vigorous debate about what would happen with women in the practice of law in Anchorage vis-a-vis male attorneys and male lawyers if we actually organized the group. And I remember Dorothy sitting there, and she said, "No man in this city who practices law has ever asked me if he could go to lunch with other men. I don't give a damn what they think." There was absolute silence in the room, and somebody right on the ball said, "Call for the question." The vote was taken, and the Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers was born. And it is due to Dorothy Holland saying, "I don't give a damn what the men think." And that's how we actually got the organization put together. Now, once organized, I just want to cover a couple more things and then I'll finish my comments. We had one basic primary purpose, and that was we wanted to support by association communication, letters, and our own personal activity, the appointment of women lawyers to the bench and to interagency advancement. Those were the two things that we wanted to accomplish. We did not get into politics. We did not decide this person running for the legislature or that person running for something else. We did not get into that. And eventually, when we got to the point where we had more than one woman applying for the same position, for a long time that was never an issue, but when it did become an issue, the organization at that time took the policy position that its role was to support the appointment of a woman. And so their communication was always, you have a qualified field, among those are one or two women, whatever it may be, and what we urge you to do is recognize that an appointment of a woman is appropriate, qualified, competent, etc. So that was one issue that was tackled easily, that was tackled early on. And the other one was finances. How do we get the money to do anything that we want to do? And I want to tell this story because I think it's an important part of the history of this organization. During this period of time, the University of Alaska contacted me and wanted to know if I would teach a class called Women and the Law. And I said, of course I will, because they were going to pay me. Okay. And immediately what I recognized is I couldn't possibly have covered all the subject of women and the law. But among the members of the association, I knew a woman who knew something about major topics of law. So what I did is I went back to the organization. I said, okay, look, this will bring in $700 a semester. So if we can just line up women to teach all these, I'll organize the course, I'll organize everything. I just need women volunteers to teach these subjects, and I outlined the subjects. Now, you will find this to be great irony, I do, that the one subject for which I had no women lawyer volunteers was divorce and family law. And so now retired Judge Reese taught that class for us, that session for us, because we had no women yet devoting themselves to that practice, or at least that wanted to volunteer to teach. So this is the way for at least 2 years, and it may have been longer, but frankly my memory fails me at that point, we had $700. Now that doesn't sound like a lot, but frankly, in the early 80s, this would do it. We had $700 coming in twice a year because of this course called Women in the Law. And it's always been a particular pleasure of mine to run into people who still today will say, you know, I remember a course. Wasn't there something out at the university? Yes, there was. But that's how we supported ourselves originally. Our focus, how to be successful women in a heavily dominated male profession. It was trying to both understand and balance what it means to and what the difference is between thinking like a man and not thinking like a man, and figuring out what that meant and the balance. Society had not yet accepted or learned, and certainly I think the legal profession had not accepted or learned, two things that are important to women in any field that has been historically and traditionally dominated by men. And that is, number one, equality is not sameness. Equality is not sameness, and difference is not deficiency. And difference is not deficiency. Thank you for letting me share these memories.
Thank you, Judge Hunt. Reminded that I should go ask the university if they need another course taught. Because finances is an issue for an organization that continues.
There you go.
So our next speaker, Judge Andrews.
Good afternoon. The best part about being on this panel was the opportunity we had as a panel to get together and to discuss what part each of us was going to talk about. And I learned a lot about the history that occurred before I came in 1976. And it is remarkable how much change there was, even from the early organizing times that Judge Hunt talks about to the time that I arrived. And as the biography in the program suggests, my first day on the job, I was a newly minted lawyer with my little, this is the 1970s, it was fashionable to wear the shirt that had the tied-up bow, so you looked a little bit like you were wearing a tie, but it was the feminine version of the tie. And I had my brand new briefcase that Hadley had a mark on it, because this was my first day at work, and I walked out at lunchtime, and I stood on the corner, and I see Judge Beckwith here, and I must have looked like the newly minted lawyer, looking left, looking right, and she said, oh, are you looking for the women lawyers lunch? I said, yes. And from that was actually my first day on the job, my first day in Anchorage in August 1976. And Judge Beckwith obviously became a judge thereafter as well. The Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers was for women in Anchorage really a wonderful place where I would say probably 85% of the women lawyers congregated. Everyone who came into town knew that this is where the women lawyers got together, and it was an enormous support for women starting the profession. And it had, because it had most of the women lawyers in it as members, we had the benefit of seasoned lawyers who could give us some guidance. And it did have a mission. It was a place where there really was a cross-pollinization. By the time I came, there were quite a few women law clerks because the court was now hiring women as law clerks. There were women in the public agencies. I mean, women were starting to come into the profession. But, you know, there are sort of silos of practice. There's sort of the private bar and the public bar, and, you know, we're all real busy. And oftentimes the practice, you don't have an opportunity to network or to even make friends with other women lawyers in town. And this was the one place where the private bar, the public bar, the more experienced women lawyers and the newbies all got together, and it was a wonderful, supportive environment. And our Karen Hunt was our first president, and she, of course, was the first woman to go on to the Superior Court in Anchorage. And I was the president in 1980. I went onto the bench, and as Judge Hunt suggested, it was the mission of the organization to promote the advancement of women in the profession, and it was a very vigorous club at that time. And, you know, when women were applying for judgeships or advancement in an agency, the agency stepped, I mean, the club stepped in and wrote letters to the governor, wrote letters to the Judicial Council. Women helped each other by explaining to the people in their firm who was running for judgeship, why they were good. It really was a very active organization. In sitting on this panel, it is interesting when we talked about how we got to where we were. I think the tone has changed. I think in those earlier days, we recognized something was shifting dramatically. I think we did view ourselves as trailblazers. We did view ourselves as people who were having to kind of break trail. And those of us who came after the first women who were here, we were slogging it up to our knees, but they had been slogging it up to their hips. And so we knew that they had broken trail before us. We still had some trail to break. And I think that gave us sort of the energy and the impetus to keep moving against some somewhat difficult situations. So my focus is a little bit more on the bench. When I came on the bench, Judge Cutler was on the bench in the district court, and Judge Cutler is here as well. And it was, we had two women on the bench, and then shortly thereafter, Judge Cutler became the Superior Court judge in Palmer. So she moved out and up. Judge Beckwith joined us, Judge Finn. I'm going to forget some of the names, and they're probably here, so I apologize. But we thought we had a great beginning. We had, within a relatively short amount of time, the Superior Court was one-third women. At one point, we had four women on the bench. It was myself, Judge Katz, who became Judge Woodward, Justice Fabe, and Judge Hunt. There were 12 Superior Court judges, and we counted ourselves four of those. I will point out to you that there are now 15 Superior Court judges. After the retirement of Judge Joannides, we'll have Judge Gleason. And if Judge Gleason should be so fortunate as to be appointed to the federal bench out of 15 Superior Court judges, there will be no women. So if people think we have continued to make advancement and to break ground and that we thought we had a good beginning, I'd like to point out to you that there are reasons, there remain reasons for an organization like the Anchorage Association of Women Judges to be active and to be involved, and for young women lawyers and middle-aged women lawyers and older women lawyers to remain united in these important things, because the failure to have a diverse bench means a lack of public trust and confidence. If the bench doesn't reflect the community and the judges are judging the community, there's a disconnect there. In fact, we are one of the 13 states in the country that has less than 20% of women on the bench. So we started out gangbusters, and it's been a slow retreat ever since. And that is not just unique to Anchorage. In Fairbanks, there were two of the four women were on this, two of the four Superior Court judges were women. Then it was 2 of 5, and now it's 0 of 6. So these are facts that I think people should take cognizance of. There, women on the bench faced interesting moments. Everyone has a little bit of a story. I have a little bit of a story. I was on the committee to build the new courthouse, the Nesbitt Courthouse, and the designs actually were quite grand at that time. This is actually a scaled-down version of what they had in mind. And I was a district court judge at the time, and one of the judges on the committee for the say something about how the courtrooms were going to be designed and how the entire courthouse was going to look. And we were including things like retail space. It was going to be quite a large complex with a street level access to the public and sort of the courts and everything above. And one of the things we were talking about was a daycare center in the courthouse. We had, a huge number of women employees for the court, and jurors who needed child care, and the daycare center was going to be an important component in the courthouse. And one of the judges on the committee basically said, well, why don't we just have a drive-through laundry? I mean, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a judge, be a lawyer, be a judge. But if you want to be a mom, be a mom. Basically, these two things were incompatible, and it was absolutely ridiculous to think about having a daycare center in any kind of a public institution. We didn't get the daycare center. The courthouse got considerably downsized, and so that was lost in that process. So I think we all have little stories, and we kind of agreed that we would maybe tell a few of those just so you can get the flavor of what might have been going on. I do have a recollection. This is a prejudged story of appearing in front of Judge Hornaday in Homer. And for those of you who recall Judge Hornaday, he was kind of a stickler for a dress code, stickler for the men as well. I don't want to suggest that he was particularly sexist, but he then had to wear ties, and there were all kinds of stories about Judge Hornaday and the men and the ties. But I was, at that time, once again, a newly minted lawyer, and my mom had bought me my first trial suit. I had this beautiful wool suit from San Francisco, and I was trying this case in Homer, and it happened to be a very warm day in Homer. And it was a fish and game case, and it was a taking moose out of season, and so the evidence was in the courtroom melting all over the court. But I was, in my final argument before the jury, and I thought I want to take off my beautiful wool jacket so that when the moose blood starts to run down my hand, it just goes onto my blouse. And I took off my jacket, and Judge Hornaday said, men and women will be wearing jackets in this courtroom. So I had to put it on with the melting moose meat running down my hand. So I think my message is there is, as Judge Hunt suggested, quite a bit that remains to be done. I think women judges have made a tremendous amount of progress. And I also, frankly, see us losing ground, and I want to bring that message to you. The other message I want to bring, and this is in the way of making statements regarding the improvement of justice and the administration of justice in Alaska, is that we have a female justice up for retention, and there has begun a campaign to make certain that she is not retained. And she is being attacked for decisions that were unanimous decisions on the court, joined in by her male colleagues, who have previously stood for retention, and no mention was made about their participation in those decisions. So I am concerned about the fact that women are uniquely visible. It makes us, it gives us more attention, and also makes us a target. And I think we need to be vigilant about the importance of the independence of the judiciary when it comes to both men and women. I think we need to be vigilant about the progress we've made increasing diversity on the bench, and I don't think that we can rest on our laurels. And so the organization that Karen Hunt got off the ground is one that is sorely needed in these days, and I hope remains vigorous for a long time to come. Thank you.
Judge Andrews, if I may just pose a question both to you and to Judge Hunt. My sense is we probably have some law clerks in the room. And it seems to me that as women judges and as you had female clerks, that's a unique relationship. If you could perhaps speak to how you encouraged your clerks to get involved in the Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers or in the legal community, because you would want to be one of their first points of contact, one of their first sort of entrees into the community. I'm assuming your mics work.
Okay. My answer to that is bribery. I paid their membership dues. Any woman, the women who clerked for me, I paid their dues. The unfortunate thing was, and this has always been the problem when you wonder if you're a practicing attorney, why the women judges seem to have dropped out of the circulation of the organization, is remember in Anchorage, the court runs until 1:30. And so as a sitting judge, it's very difficult, at least on the trial bench, to make the meetings of this or any other organization, frankly, because your lunch is over before we get the lunch recess. So often the clerks had memberships, but they weren't able to go because of the trial court schedule. Now, I don't.
I'm going to take this opportunity not to answer that question precisely. I'm going to do another little comment on sort of the backsliding, and this is a story I tell on myself without being very proud of it at all. Not too long ago, I had a wonderful law clerk and, you know, hired her. She was fabulous, and, you know, as Karen Hunt suggests, you spent a lot of your time on the bench, and so, you know, didn't have a whole lot of time to spend with the law clerk chatting, but I walked into her office maybe 3 weeks after she'd been hired, and I looked on her shelf, and there was this picture of this little baby on the shelf, and I said, sort of, you know, is this your child? And she said, I mean, I did not realize that she, you know, she had a little child at home, and of course I'd asked her to stay late to do various and assorted research projects, and I, you know, I said, we haven't worked this hard for you not to share with me, you know, the needs that you have to balance your work and your family. I really felt like I had stepped back in time to 20 years ago when you couldn't talk about your kids and you couldn't talk about your family needs because the work that wasn't recognized in the workplace. And so we had a long talk, and actually she talked about having another child, and I said, if you stay with me one more year, have that child on my watch, I'll make it up to you. So she did.
Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to Linda O'Bannon, who's going to talk to us a little bit about women in the profession.
Would you hand me that folder that I've stuck in that drawer? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I guess I'm the non-judicial token today. Certainly two wonderful women retired judges that I'm following today. In thinking about this and what I was going to say, I found it a little bit painful, a little bit depressing to go back to the years I was in law school, 1974 through 1977, the year I was admitted, 1977 in Alaska, and think about what the status of women in the profession actually was at that time, and think about the status of women at that time. And because this is a historical luncheon, I decided that I would kind of set the scene so forth. And many of you who are at least my age will remember that there was proposed an Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Of course, it was not ratified. And that Equal Rights Amendment said very simply, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Well, the Equal Rights Amendment passed both houses of the Congress in 1972, and Alaska did ratify the ERA, But the ERA failed to gain ratification in 3/4 of the states before its June 30th, 1982 deadline. And I bring this up in part because in this photograph, I've kind of racked my brain. That is me with my son, Gabe, who's now 32 years old. And with what we were doing at that particular time, and as best I can remember, it was about 1980, and we were attending a rally on the Park Strip in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment. Unfortunately, there was a very strong national conservative group called the Eagle Forum. It was headed up by a woman, Phyllis Schlafly, and they successfully opposed the ratification of that Equal Rights Amendment. It's still somewhat shocking when I think back on that history. In 1977, there were no women justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. There were no women on the Alaska Supreme Court, and women were in a very small minority in the law school classes of the 1970s. Some other things that I look back on, no women at that time were admitted to any of the U.S. military academies, West Point, the Naval Academy, etc. Congress finally passed a law, and women were first admitted to the U.S. service academies in 1976. In 1975, as late as 1975, there were states that would not allow women jurors. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Taylor versus Louisiana that excluding women from jury pools was illegal. And very important legislation was passed by the U.S. Congress in 1978, and it was the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. And it made employment discrimination on the basis of pregnancy or childbirth illegal for the first time. As you know, in 1981, Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female U.S. Supreme Court justice. Interestingly enough, shortly thereafter, there was a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was in Hishon versus King and Spalding, and the decision was that women could claim bias in partnership decisions by law firms.
That's right.
That firm was a firm in Georgia, and reportedly some southern law firms at that time held bikini contests for their women associates. And King and Spalding was considering holding a wet t-shirt contest for the firm's summer associates while this case was pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. So against that backdrop, let me address my association with the Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers and a little bit about my experience in those years in private practice and ultimately public practice in Anchorage. I'll never forget one of my first Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers meetings. Mary Hughes was president then, and Beverly Cutler was first being introduced as a candidate for appointment to the state district court. And Beverly is here today, of course, and she recently retired from the Superior Court. I was very impressed with Beverly and the other women I met through the Anchorage Association of Women Lawyers, and I got very much support there. We thought that it was most important to support our women judicial candidates. And when Elaine was president, I was treasurer, and we had our first male member who was Jamie Fisher. He was secretary when Elaine was president, and was very supportive of all the women in the organization, I might add. I remember when Elaine was appointed to the state district court, I wrote an article for a then-existing magazine. It was Alaska Women's Magazine, and it featured Elaine on the cover in her judicial robes, in a very nice color photograph. So I think we really worked at that time for women to be appointed to judicial positions. One thing also I remember, I just benefited so much from association with a few women attorneys who were a bit more experienced than I was. And at that time, there was a diner on 4th Avenue, and it was around 4th and K, and it had a glass front, and male attorneys would meet there for lunch, and on one day a week, it would just be packed. It was a Wednesday. And I remember many times walking by that diner and seeing all the men attorneys in there having lunch and just thinking, would I ever have the nerve to walk through that door? And I, of course I didn't. And I just think my early days in practice in Anchorage without the Women Lawyers Association would have been very lonely. Many times I thank my lucky stars that I spent my legal career here in Anchorage because I do believe there were a lot of opportunities for women in the law. And I think there were a great deal more than where I grew up, which was in the Deep South. And most of my early practice days were spent at a law firm that was in Hagen Smith, Brown, Irwin, and Gibbs. I was the first woman attorney in the firm. I was allowed to try civil cases on my own and be the lead attorney in trials. Charlie Hagens and Sandy Gibbs have both passed on, but they were great mentors to me, as was Keith Brown of that firm. Karen Hunt was one of my great early mentors and role models. We worked on some of the same cases together, and I really learned a lot from her. Susan Mason was the first woman attorney at the Atkinson Conway firm, and we became a two-person lunch support group for each other for about a year. At that time, there were firms in Anchorage who refused to hire women. And some of those firms did not hire any women until the late 1980s. On to public practice, where I spent much of my career. I think I was very fortunate. I had another wonderful mentor. It was Connie Sipe, and she recruited me to come to the AG's office. And Connie, at that time, was head of the Consumer Protection Section. And she trained me for about a year and then turned the reins over to me. I'll always be grateful to her. In 1987, I became chief of the commercial section in Anchorage, and at that time supervised up to 25 people. And there were many wonderful role models in the AG's office, and many of them were women. And the ethical standards of the people I worked with were the highest, and there was great devotion to the public good and to the work. However, we've only had one woman attorney general in Alaska, and that was Grace Berg Scheibel, and she was appointed by Governor Cooper. She served from 1987 to 1989. The attorney general's office did not employ a woman as deputy attorney general until 1994, after the appointment of Bruce Botello as attorney general. Elizabeth Shaw, who was an assistant AG for many years in Juneau, served as the first woman deputy AG in the civil section from 1994 to 1995. Laurie Otto served as the first woman deputy attorney general in the criminal section, and that was 1995 through 1997. And there was not a woman appointed as chief of the civil section in Anchorage until Cherie Jacobus, who was actually a political appointment through Governor Hickel and Attorney General Coe, became the chief of the Anchorage Civil Office. Rebecca Snow, a longtime assistant AG in Fairbanks, about that same time became head of that office. Unfortunately, I don't think gender bias is completely over in our profession or in general. Sadly, in doing a bit of research on gender bias in the legal profession, I came across some fairly sad reported decisions. The worst of those, with the most horrific facts, was a case, Lewis versus McDade, 54 F. Sup. 1332, in the Northern District of Georgia in 1999. And I'm just going to read one little piece of the facts. I won't spoil your lunch or shock the younger people who are here by reading the entire facts. But this was an elected district attorney in Georgia who had assistant district attorneys who were women and other assistants in his office that were women. And here's direct from that decision. On two occasions, defendant McDade hit plaintiff Carver. On the first occasion, he hit her in the presence of the head of the Council on Battered Women in Atlanta. Defendant McDade said he did it to see what the reaction of the director of the Council on Battered Women would be. Plaintiff Carver was shocked and did not laugh or think the matter was a joke. On that occasion, the second occasion occurred in the last year of Plaintiff Carver's employment. On that occasion, defendant McDade simply walked up and hit her. He did not say anything, but the hit left a mark on her. Plaintiff Carver simply responded, "Ouch, that hurt." And there are worse facts in this opinion. So to think that there's not some gender bias, but as I said before, I thank my lucky stars. I'm certain. Can you imagine what would happen in Alaska if some male legal boss hit a woman in front of the head of a wake? They would last about 10 minutes. It's pretty amazing, some of the things that happen. But I just want to say in closing, now women make up well over 50% of the law school classes. I'm just hoping I live another 30 years to see what the future of the legal profession will be. And I'm hopeful that in another 30 years, if not before, at least half of the nation's judiciary will be women, and that the women will be controlling partners in many of the leading law firms, and that attorneys, as a result, will gain a renewed respect as a profession. And also, I want to just mention, there is a book, unless you were actually in the AG's office, it's probably the cure for insomnia, but it's called The Law of the Land, and Stephen Haycox wrote it, and it does have a really detailed history of the Office of the Department, the Office of the Attorney General in the Department of Law. Thank you.
We have, the only question we received, or pink card we received, told me to put my mic on. So I have a question for the audience. How many women lawyers in the room right now either have been or are currently members of AAWL?
Needs to be more.
That's great. Please come to the meetings. And I do have a question for the panel as well. All three of you have clearly been tremendous mentors. But you had mentors as well. And I wonder if you could speak to the differences, if any, between the mentoring you received and the mentoring you provided. Has it changed? Has your experience changed how you have counseled other women?
Well, I come from an era in which we didn't even have the word mentoring. And as I recall, I don't think we had the word networking, both of which I wish we had had at that time. I, quite frankly, don't recall a lot of mentoring, and it was something that I recognized women were doing with each other, and some of the men who got it, who understood what this fight was really about. And interesting enough, it was often male attorneys who had daughters. They got it sooner than anybody else because they were looking at the future of their daughters and recognizing some of the things that they were seeing that were limitations. So I'm not a very good conversationalist about mentoring because I don't remember really having mentoring going on. But I remember specific times in which I thought that men had gone out of their way to be very gracious, to be very kind, to be very supportive of what I was doing. I tried to do that differently because so much of my experience really comes from the way in which those 11 women in my law school figured out how to make this work for all of us by making it work together for all of us. And that served as my mentoring model for a very long time, which is the way in which you try to be supportive but not controlling, and let people make their own choices. So I'm not sure I'm a very good model for mentoring either, as a matter of fact. And I don't know what this means.
Well, I would just say, one of the things, I didn't mention this in my talk, but one of the advantages of being part of the Women Lawyers Association early on was many of us were struggling with raising children and having families and having many other obligations. And I remember we had programs on basically, you know, time management, how to, I just remembered something that Elaine said at one of those programs, which was hire anything done that you could get done. But I think those were helpful. And when I was in a supervisory position in the AG's office, one of the things that I really consciously did, was to try to promote time for women to deal with their families. And also, I will say the only real overt gender bias I ever felt in the Attorney General's office was when, in the hiring process, when I was trying to hire other women. And once I hired, with the approval of my boss then, who was head of the civil section and a male, a woman who was pregnant. And much to my shock and chagrin, got a really scathing email from the then Deputy Attorney General, and this is way back, you know, not recently, as to what in the world we were doing hiring a pregnant woman. Well, she was the best candidate. It's illegal to discriminate against women for that purpose, and of course, she just retired from the AG's office, so I mean, she was obviously a great employee for a number of years, but so I would say that that's one thing I think, just as Elaine told the story about her law clerk, that maybe some women attorneys have been a little more attuned to, trying to be a little bit more conscious of the family needs as well.
And I think that's true not only for sort of women in the profession, and as presiding judge, I certainly try to encourage policies that gave sort of flexible hours, you know, tried to do things that made sense. I know when Justice Faye was head of the Public Defender Agency, they had all kinds of rotating, half-time, you know, all kinds of ways in which you would try and accomplish these things. And, you know, part of the mentoring was really sort of watching how other women did. Judge Cutler had a child when she was on the bench, and of course there wasn't, I mean, judges were males. There was no maternity leave for judges because why would you need maternity leave? There weren't any women to take maternity leave. And Judge Cutler, a much stronger woman than I am, you know, sort of took the minimum time. I think she was back on the bench 2 weeks after the baby was born. I mean, she was remarkable, along with sort of going out to the valley and felling trees and building log homes and doing all of that sort of stuff.
That's true.
I had both of my kids while I was a judge, and I took a completely opposite approach, and really had a battle with the Supreme Court. I said, I want my time off, and and here's what I want. And the Chief Justice at that time basically told me to pound salt. And I said, well, I mean, if you won't give me what I want, I'm going to quit. And thank goodness the Chief Justiceship was changing at that time. And Justice Rabinowitz became the Chief Justice, and I swear it was the first thing he did right after he took his oath of office the Chief. I swear it was 5 minutes later I got a call, and he said, what do you want? And I told him what I wanted, and he said, you have it. And so there really was, I think, I mean, he certainly recognized the value of women on the bench, and he promoted that, and he had daughters. So I think that there was probably a connection there as well. So, yeah, I think that, you know, that's part of the difference that having women both in the profession and on the bench and working with women together, there is a lot that our experience is different than the men. I mean, as Karen suggests, it's different doesn't mean diminished, it just means different. And there were things that we had to face that our, you know, our male counterparts didn't. And we figured out a way to support each other to meet those needs.
Well, I want to thank the panel very much and the moderator for a wonderful day. And the bread. The person at the table closest to the back of the room at each table gets the bread. If there are two of you there, they're at the same distance from the back of the room where you're next to each other, then flip a coin. Anyway, I want to thank everybody on behalf of the bar and the panel for coming today. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Good.